This is Law and Disorder.
Today on Law and Disorder, we discuss a recent victory against private military contractors.
You recall the Nisour Square massacre in Iraq. It was Blackwater then. It's called Academy today. But in any case, it was found guilty, or some of its employees were found guilty of murder.
We'll talk with Professor Marjorie Cohn about her new book, Drones and Targeted Killing.
In how many ways is Obama worse than Bush? Well, here's a big one, killing more and more people with drones. This book explains it all, the legal, moral, and geopolitical issues.
Stay with us.
New York City attorney and author Michael Smith.
I'm Heidi Boghossian, executive director of the A.J. Mustey Memorial Institute.
And I'm Michael Ratner, president emeritus of the Center for Constitutional Rights.
Michael, there's been an interesting and hopefully an important break in the Julian Assange case. Tell us about it.
You know, this week has been an extraordinary week in a certain way because I'm finally seeing, or we're seeing perhaps, some movement by Sweden in the Assange case. Assange has now been in the Ecuadorian embassy where he's been granted asylum for over 2 years. That asylum was granted because of the fear that if he goes to Sweden to deal with allegations of sexual misconduct, Sweden will ultimately send him to the United States and very rapidly, where he may be facing everything from espionage charges to computer fraud charges to other kinds of charges. The U.S. has said it's continuing to investigate Julian Assange and WikiLeaks. So here's what happened. A few months ago, not even that long ago, perhaps a couple of months ago, the Swedish lawyers went into a Swedish court. And they said to the Swedish court, look at what's going on here. Julian Assange has now been in the embassy for 2 years. We've offered many times that you, the prosecutor, can go to the UK and question him in the embassy. You can do it any way you want. You can do it by Skype. You can go there in person. You can do it by telephone. You can do it. And there's no reason that you haven't done it. Why have you not done this? Because that's the way to get this case off the ground. It may be that when you go there, in fact, I think it's likely it'll be, that there'll be no case left when you go and do it. But for some reason, the prosecutor in Sweden has refused to take advantage of the offer that Assange has made and his lawyers have made to go into the embassy and question him. So then the lawyers in Sweden went to court in Sweden and they said, look, she's not pursuing this case in a way that's meaningful. She can't just make allegations, or she's not made charges yet, but have a case involving allegations and then sit on her hands. In this case, the prosecutor is a woman, sit on her hands and not do anything about it. Because what's happening is it's unlawfully putting him in custody because he can't leave the embassy because he's been given asylum. He'd have to be giving up his international law right to asylum to actually go to Sweden. And you can't force him to do that. So by your failing to question him, you're basically keeping him in custody at the embassy. And that's illegal. It's illegal for you not to continue your investigation of him. And it's disproportional to him because he's in custody compared to the burden on you to go to the embassy. So that litigation has been going on in Sweden. It's a very strong litigation in my view. I recently read the appeal brief on it. It's very strong. The lowest court in Sweden denied the petition of Julian Assange. They said, essentially, they didn't say anything, but we're not going to force her to go to Sweden. I mean, to go to Ecuador embassy to do this questioning, etc. The case is now on appeal. Again, a strong appeal. Last week, as I was looking at the case and what was happening, all of a sudden, we see a statement by the British, or at least by the foreign minister, Hugo Swire. And here's what he said in the House of Commons last week. He said, these are matters for the Swedish prosecutor to decide on. Is this question of whether the Swedish prosecutor should come to London. But if she wished to travel here to question Mr. Assange in the embassy in London, we would do absolutely everything to facilitate that. Indeed, we would actively welcome it. That's the foreign minister of the UK saying that. That's extraordinary, because up until that day, Britain has said nothing, but this is a matter between Sweden and Julian Assange, or Sweden and Ecuador. We have nothing to do with this. So all of a sudden, in the middle of an appeal that's going quite well for Julian Assange, you see a statement like that by the UK foreign minister, essentially inviting the Swedish to come into England and question him. Now, you ask yourself, what's going on? Do we really know what's going on? Can we speculate what's going on? Conceivably, what's going on is either they have advanced knowledge that the Swedish court is going to go in a certain direction, or there's some pressure within England saying, let's get, this is crazy. We're spending millions of dollars, millions of pounds to watch that embassy. And yet the Swedish prosecutor is just sitting there. They're putting pressure essentially on the Swedish prosecutor, or you could look at it another way. They actually are giving the Swedish prosecutor an excuse saying, now we've been invited to London. Maybe we'll go to London now. We don't know. We do know that so far the Swedish prosecutor hasn't exactly been straightforward about the response. The first response was in The Guardian, quote, that it was all news to her and she would respond publicly in the next few days. We don't know whether it was all news to her or not, but the statement she made shortly after that invitation by the foreign minister of the UK is, quote, as to the question of interviewing Assange in London, I refer to my earlier statement, which is available on the Swedish Prosecution Authority's webpage. I have no other information to submit today. And that's where I think she's being perhaps a bit cagey. The Swedish proceedings are underway, and I will await the Court of Appeals decision on the detention of Julian Assange, which is expected in the near future. We don't know what she's really saying. Let me just give a minute of background, because the claim of Julian Assange and his lawyers was that there was no reason not to question him at the embassy. She came up with no real good reason why she's not doing it. She claimed there had to be certain tests that had to be made, but in fact Julian has had a DNA test, and there's not any dispute about the fact that he had sexual relationships with the two women, so the DNA is sort of irrelevant, but he has had the test anyway, and he'd be glad, I think, to have that test if they went to the embassy. But they don't need to because they already have it, or they should have it because the British police did it. So she didn't really come up with a good excuse for not doing it. And so it seems to me that there's a fair chance, to the extent she sticks with the appeal in Sweden, she's going to lose. The court is somehow going to say either we have to get rid of this case or you have to question him one way or another. It's too long. It's the longest case of pretrial investigation in Swedish history in which the prosecutor has simply sat on her hands.
What's at stake here for the United States government? And then, because I make a distinction here, what's at stake for the American people?
Right. What's at stake for the United States government is if he doesn't have to go to Sweden, then it becomes a clear conflict between the United States and Julian Assange's grant of asylum by Ecuador and the UK, perhaps. You take Sweden out of the mix, you got this basically. What Sweden did here is it diverted people's attention from really the main underlying core of the problem here, which is the U.S. wants to go after and is going after Julian Assange and WikiLeaks. And once that the Swedish case is out of the way in some way or another, we can focus on what really the problem is here, the U.S. prosecution of whistleblowers, journalists, and publishers being the underlying problem, and hopefully get the U.K. to recognize the asylum in the place where he's gotten it, in Ecuador, and give him free passage to Ecuador. So this is a big break in the sense that it's the first real dispute we've seen, that Sweden is looking bad. And in fact, in Sweden, there was a recent article the day after all of this happened. It was an opinion piece in the main tabloid called Expressen, and it was published a couple of days after this whole statement by the UK foreign minister that they would welcome having Sweden come and question Julian Assange. And it's headlined, it's the opinion piece in the main tabloid in Sweden. It's headlined, quote, everyone is tired of the Assange circus. And then it says, quote, the message from Britain's deputy foreign minister, I'm sorry, I didn't mean the foreign minister, the deputy foreign minister, Swire, for Marianne Nye, who's the prosecutor, could not be clearer. Travel to London for God's sake. And that's the main tabloid in Sweden. That would have never happened 2 years ago in Sweden. There's a change in opinion going on within Sweden because I think they're afraid that they just look like fools and idiots. And what are they doing
here? Tools of the United States.
And what are they doing here? Costing the British taxpayers millions of pounds to guard the embassy because Marianne Nye is sitting on her hands in Sweden. So we'll update you as we go on here, but this in this ongoing and important story.
Assange can't go home to Australia because Australia will send him to the United States. Brave little Ecuador was willing to give him asylum. and stand up against the pressure of the United States.
I think that's true, and there was a lot of pressure. Early on, when after Ecuador did it, there were articles in the Washington Post, including an editorial, saying Ecuador's trade preference ought to be withdrawn.
Yeah.
And that's a trade preference that, you know, certain nations got to trade on more favorable terms with the United States, and they were going to take Ecuador's away. But it just tells you the bravery of Ecuador, because Ecuador did not necessarily know they would be able to keep trading when they did it, and they knew it might offend the United States. And they've stuck through with Julian on in this asylum issue through thick and thin.
The vote last week in the United Nations, Cuba made a motion in front of the General Assembly. Remember, the United Nations is made up of 193 countries, and Cuba made a motion to condemn the American embargo against the island, which has gone on for over 50 years now, which has caused more than $1 trillion in damages to the economy of Cuba, which it has stunted and distorted. The vote of the 193 countries was 188 on one side in favor of Cuba to 2. The only vote that the United States picked up was its ally Israel. 3 countries, Palau, Micronesia, and another small Asian country, didn't vote and abstained. So it was just this overwhelming vote on the part of the entire planet against the United States and Israel. Well, the question is, why does the United States continue to enforce the embargo, continue to insult the rest of the world with what is clearly an illegal embargo? Why does it do it? And the answer is simple. It does it because it's working. The Cuban economy hasn't been able to develop in a healthy way that it would have liked to. The Cubans, when they made their revolution for their own independence against the United States in 1959, sought to take control over their own economy, an economy that was pretty much owned lock, stock, and barrel by American corporations. And the United States initiated the embargo when the Cubans nationalized American property. It's been going on ever since. And the United States wanted to make sure that the example of Cuba, the example of a planned economy that could grow much more rationally than an irrational capitalist economy, which is run by the notion of profit rather than human need. The United States wanted to make sure that that example would not flourish in the world. That's why it initiated the embargo, and that's why it stands with Israel 188-2 to continue that embargo.
Michael, what's fascinating always to me about that vote, which goes every year, is who votes against it and who abstains. Well, Micronesia and Palau, I'm not sure they always
abstain. And the Marshall Islands.
And the Marshall Islands. Okay, Micronesia, Palau, and then Marshall Islands. I'm not sure they always abstain. Sometimes they vote against.
Yeah.
But now they're abstaining. And I think at least 2 out of 3, I think all 3 perhaps, were used to be trust territories of the United States.
Yeah.
And we actually represented Palau, the center did, or some faction in Palau that was against the referendum, and we got the referendum set aside that essentially made it part of the United States. I mean, really, for all practical purposes, put in the U.S. people into Palau. So those 3 countries are just like, that's trust territories. Israel's actually another example, of course, total colony. I call it a suburb of the United States, or certainly a suburb of the Jewish community of the United States. $3 billion a year in aid. Basically, as Chomsky said, our aircraft carrier in the Middle East. But what's most interesting about Israel is, as my trips to Cuba occasionally, I would see like this orchard over here, this big orange orchard. And of course, Israelis are good at oranges because they stole all the oranges, the Jaffa orange from the Palestinians in Jaffa and throughout Israel. They're good at oranges now. They raise oranges in Cuba. So Israeli businessmen are all over Cuba. I mean, there's no embargo within Israel against investing in Cuba. In fact, I think the figure is they were the second biggest investor in Cuba after the Spanish. So think about this. Israel's voting for the embargo of Cuba in the United Nations. For what reason? Just the United States says do it when they're doing millions, probably billions of dollars worth of business in Cuba for Israelis. So what does that tell you about the U.S. relationship to Israel? Well, you don't have to hear it. You've heard it here before.
A probing analysis on the use of drones for targeted assassination by the Obama administration is explored in Professor Marjorie Cohn's new book, Drones and Targeted Killing: Legal, Moral, and Geopolitical Issues. It's a collection of various disciplines, including sociologists, legal scholars, and human rights activists, that examine aspects of the U.S. policy of targeted killings with drones and also by other methods. The book documents civilian casualties and discusses the first U.S. targeted killing lawsuit by the attorney who brought the case. Thomas Jefferson School of Law professor and former president of the National Lawyers Guild, Marjorie Cohn joins us to talk about targeted killings and drones. Welcome, Marjorie, to Law and Disorder.
My pleasure, Heidi.
Well, your wonderful new book, Drones and Targeted Killing, has one of the most impressive lineups of contributors that we've seen. What motivated you to put this compilation together?
Well, drones have become the Obama administration's preferred weapon of choice. The Bush administration used them, but Obama has used them much more extensively. Drones have killed more people than died on 9/11. Since they were initiated. And the reason that the Obama administration likes them so much is because we don't lose any Americans. There are no pilots to be shot down, and they're less unpopular. And since we rarely see images of the victims of drone strikes, the overwhelming majority of whom are civilians, and we don't hear their stories because the media sanitizes what's happening in the Middle East, we really don't have a sense of the devastation that is wreaked by drones. And since Obama is only going to continue and even increase his use of drones, and looks like in the conceivable future presidents may do so as well, I thought that it was important to put together a collection that talked about different aspects of this drone policy. Is it legal? Is it moral? What are the political ramifications? Does it make us safer? Does it make us less safe? Does it help us fight terrorism? And so I gathered together the writers, and I have to say that the reason I chose Archbishop Desmond Tutu to write the foreword was because of this whole concept of American exceptionalism. You know, we're better than anyone else. And there was very little pushback by people in the United States against the use of killer drones until it became clear that, there was a leak of a white paper from the Department of Justice that showed certain standards for killing U.S. citizens in targeted killings,
well,
many of them with drones.
That's what I wanted to ask you about, Marjorie. Standards, is this legal? Is this lawful, killing over 3,000 people? What's the legal basis for this?
Well, the Obama administration is claiming claiming that the authorization for the use of military force that Congress gave Bush after the 9/11 attacks authorizes Obama to kill anybody he wants anywhere in the world, as long as he says, well, they're associated with al-Qaeda. But that authorization for the use of military force was very limited. It was only limited to groups and countries that supported the 9/11 attacks. And Congress specifically rejected the Bush administration's request for open-ended military authority to deter and preempt any future acts of terrorism against the United States. And yet, the Obama administration has been relying on this as its legal authority. Moreover, the United Nations Charter, which is a treaty the United States has ratified and therefore part of U.S. law under the Supremacy Clause of the Constitution, makes it very clear that countries cannot use armed force in other countries unless they're acting in self-defense. And the concept of the whole world being a battlefield because there might conceivably be a terrorist attack against Americans stretches the concept of self-defense to a ridiculous point. And so, no, targeted extrajudicial killings off the battlefield are illegal.
Marjorie, I want to bring our listeners back for a second to the book. It's called Drones and Targeted Killing. It's edited by Marjorie Cohn. It talks about the legal, moral, and geopolitical issues. And one of the things that I was amazed by was the contributors to the book. Really, I want to give our listeners a sense of how important this book is because it includes an extraordinary range of people talking about this issue.
Well, first of all, Archbishop Desmond Tutu wrote a letter to the editor of the New York Times, which caught my eye, saying, why are people in the United States so upset when Americans might be killed, but not when non-Americans might be killed? And this raises the whole issue of American exceptionalism, which is why I asked him to write the foreword, and he graciously agreed. Richard Falk, who is a very prominent international law expert and also the former UN Special Rapporteur to the Occupied Palestinian Territories, wrote a very interesting and, I should say, provocative chapter called Why Drones Are More Dangerous Than Nuclear Weapons. And his position is basically that nuclear weapons have not been used since 1945 except for deterrence and coercive diplomacy, but drones are unconstrained by any system of regulation. And then Harry Vanderlinden, who is a philosopher, he edits Radical Philosophy, the journal, uses just war principles to talk about the problems with drones. John Quigley, who is a professor at Ohio State University, talks about the blowback from drones and how they actually make us less safe, because when people see their families blown up, they resent the United States even more, and young boys are even more susceptible to joining groups that would do harm to the United States. So he talks about the history of U.S. foreign policy and the resentment it's caused in those countries against the United States.
Marjorie, I thought that was an interesting chapter. John Quigley also suggests that the Obama administration is well aware of the risks of blowback, but continues, nevertheless, this policy.
Yes, that's correct, Heidi. He has even expanded his use of drones now in Iraq and Syria. He's using drones. He's also using piloted aircraft and using this authorization for the use of military force, which does not apply at all. This ISIS and Khorasan, the current groups that are doing horrible things over there, are not covered by the authorization for use of military force. And so he is actually acting beyond what Congress has authorized, to say nothing of the fact that it violates the UN Charter. And, you know, I want to say, Heidi, that there's a very interesting quote in the Jane Mayer chapter, and this was written back in 2009. But she quotes Vicki DeVall, a former CIA lawyer who now teaches at the U.S. Navy Naval Academy in Annapolis. And Vicki DeVall said, quote, "People are a lot more comfortable with a predator strike that kills many people than with a throat slitting that kills one." And think about that. I mean, the way that the Obama administration has been able to whip up this furor about ISIS, and of course ISIS is doing horrible things, is by publicizing the fact that they have slit the throat of American journalists, and of course the fact that they're American makes it even more egregious in the minds of many people. But I would love to see that level of outrage against drone strikes that blow up children and body parts are spewed all over the place, and yet we don't hear about that. That's not in our consciousness, and that is equally horrific. The numbers of civilians that have been killed by these drone strikes. The Bureau of Investigative Journalism just came out with a report earlier this month saying that only 4% of drone victims in Pakistan were al-Qaeda members or even associated with al-Qaeda, which means that the overwhelming number of the almost 2,400 people who have been killed in Pakistan by drone strikes are civilians.
Let's bring the story home to America. What's the scene with drones flying over our skies here, and what's the worst-case scenario?
Well, right now the FAA bans commercial drones, but the FAA Modernization and Reform Act of 2012 requires the FAA to integrate drones into U.S. airspace by September of 2015 to legalize commercial drones and to allow some government agencies to use small drones. This is very, very worrisome because of the privacy considerations primarily and the capacity for abuse, targeting people of color, for example, law enforcement using drones to hunt out the bad guys, whereas in fact racial profiling will probably increase tremendously. Although we do see little drones, we talk about Amazon drones and photography drones, and drones can be used, to locate missing children, to help put out forest fires, etc. But when people in the Customs Department talk about using them at the border, and they say, oh, don't worry, we're not going to use armed drones at the border, nevertheless, Jay Stanley says, that's a slippery slope. And if we get into border enforcement through the use of armed drones, that could turn into a disaster.
What is the process that the Obama administration, and particularly Obama, go through in order to target somebody for a drone strike? Is this something that goes through the White House?
Yes, it does, directly. I mean, he and John Brennan is the CIA director and used to be the counterterrorism director, and they would sit down on what are called Terror Tuesdays to decide who was going to be killed that week. This was blown wide open by a New York Times article a couple of years ago. And so there are two different kinds of drone strikes that the Obama administration carries out. One is called personality strikes, where they target suspected bad guys. They call them militants. That could mean anything. They may get the right people. They may not get the right people. And no due process, of course. Just take them out, assassinate them. The other type of attack is called signature strikes. And that is a kind of a strike that is carried out in an area of suspicious activity. So if you happen to be a male between the ages of 16 and, 65 or something, then you're fair game if you're in a suspicious area, even though the Obama administration doesn't know your identity. They don't know the people that they're killing. And so you can imagine how so many civilians could be killed. And then they engage in what is called a double tap, where first they kill people with drone strikes, and then when rescuers come to rescue the wounded and take the bodies away, then another drone strike kills the rescuers. That's a double tap. But I believe that it should be called a triple tap, because then when the people hold a funeral for their loved ones, then the United States drones come in and kill people at the funeral. This is an outrageous practice, engendering tremendous resentment and anger against the United States. Now, in 2013, in May of 2013, Obama gave kind of a defensive speech. He was coming under attack for the force feeding of prisoners at Guantanamo, which the UN has called torture, and some anger about drones, particularly about drones being used against U.S. citizens. And so he gave a speech in May of 2013, and at that same time, the administration issued a fact sheet with preconditions for using lethal force in targeted killings. They didn't release the entire policy, just kind of a summary fact sheet.
Marjorie, actually, I was going to ask you about that Obama speech, because that's where the claim was made that he would tighten the regulations. So I'm really interested in what you're saying on this.
Right, right. So the first requirement is that there be a legal basis for the use of lethal force. It doesn't define what legal basis is. It doesn't talk about the UN Charter and the prohibition on the use of military force. The second precondition is the target must pose a continuing imminent threat to U.S. persons. But the fact sheet doesn't define continuing or imminent. And the leaked Department of Justice white paper said that a U.S. citizen can be killed even where there is no, quote, clear evidence that a specific attack on U.S. persons and interests will take place in the immediate future, unquote. What kind of imminence is that? Third, there must be near certainty that the terrorist target is present. Neither the fact sheet nor the Obama speech addressed whether the administration would continue its signature strikes, its crowd killings, which don't target individuals but rather areas of suspicious activity. And I understand they are continuing those signature strikes. Fourth, there must be near certainty that non-combatants will not be injured or killed. But it's because of the level of civilian casualties that organizations like the Bureau of Investigative Journalism continue to document, it does not seem that particular requirement is being enforced. And then fifth, there must be an assessment that capture is not feasible at the time of the operation. It's unclear what feasibility means. The white paper appears to indicate that infeasible means inconvenient. And certainly when Obama initiated that assassination of Osama bin Laden, he could have been arrested and taken in for a trial. Nobody was armed there. Capture certainly was feasible, and yet he did not go that route. Number six, there must be an assessment that relevant governmental authorities in the country where the attack is contemplated cannot or will not effectively address the, quote, threat to U.S. persons, unquote, and that is left undefined. And seventh, there must be an assessment that no other reasonable alternatives exist to address the, quote, threat to U.S. persons, unquote, also left undefined. But the fact sheet would excuse those preconditions, all of those preconditions, when the president takes action in, quote, extraordinary circumstances, unquote, which are, quote, both lawful and necessary to protect the United States or its allies, unquote, with no definition of extraordinary circumstances. Moreover, Michael, Obama has claimed that in his expanding wars in Iraq and Syria, he doesn't have to follow these preconditions, which it doesn't look like he's following anyway. So they have these, they're on the books, but do they follow them? It does not appear to be the case.
Can the White House kill an American citizen with a drone?
The White House can kill an American citizen with a drone. If somebody is about to attack the United States and mount an armed attack, and if there is an imminent threat, and this is basic principles of criminal law and self-defense, yes, that can be done in self-defense. But there has to be an imminent threat of death or great bodily injury in order to kill someone off the battlefield.
Well, then how did they get away with murdering Al-Awlaki and then his son several weeks later?
Well, they get away with it because they go into court and fight against the Center for Constitutional Rights lawsuit by saying, well, this court doesn't have jurisdiction because there's no standing. It's not clear anybody's actually been harmed yet, and this was before Al-Awlaki was killed. And also that lawsuit, the CCR lawsuit, was dismissed based on the political question ground that the courts are not the proper forum to decide political questions. That's for the executive branch. That lawsuit and the fate of that lawsuit is discussed in Pardis Kabrai's chapter in the book.
We're speaking with Marjorie Cohn. The book is called Drones and Targeted Killing, Legal, Moral, and Geopolitical Issues. It's extraordinary. Each chapter, each contributor really is remarkable in their essays, from Richard Falk to Marjorie writing the introduction, to Tom Hayden, and more. As I look at the book and I hear you speak, things don't seem to be getting better on this issue, despite opposition from Code Pink to many others, and this book, obviously, and a lot of people who oppose it. The last essay is called To Stop the Drones by Tom Hayden, but your thoughts on how this movement ought to move to stop them, or at least limit them in some way, and maybe some summary of what Tom thinks.
Yes, well, Tom's main point is increased transparency, and I think he's absolutely correct. Until we bring the images of the victims of these drone strikes and their stories into the American consciousness, people are not going to be concerned about them. There will be little pockets of left progressive groups who will stand on street corners and protest against drones. And so it means that shows like yours, books like mine, articles that we write in the alternative media need to get this information out. We need to get photographs into people's consciousness. We need to bring their stories into the national discourse. Just like during Vietnam, although they did try to sanitize what we saw during that time as well, that very iconic image of the, I think, 9-year-old girl running naked away from an American bomber, which had just dropped napalm on her, that's what turned me against the war, was seeing a film, a black and white film, that had those images in it of what U.S. bombs were doing in Vietnam, that just completely reversed my feeling about the United States foreign policy and the war in Vietnam and turn me into an activist. And that continues to this day. So I really think that the information needs to get to the American people because it will tug at their heartstrings when they see what we're doing. They hear, they read accounts in the corporate media about the terrorists, the suspected militants. They hear about beheadings and they think, of course, that's horrible. Kill them. They're going to make us unsafe, and it's out of their consciousness. But if we actually bring those images and stories into their consciousness, I think that there would be pushback. And also, it means agitating and contacting, pressuring Congress, pressuring the White House, writing op-eds, writing letters to the editor, writing articles, demonstrating, taking mass action. All of those things need to be launched because Obama is continuing and even escalating a permanent war where the whole world is a battlefield. And this is going to go on indefinitely unless and until we stop it.
We've been speaking with Marjorie Cohn, the former president of the National Lawyers Guild, currently a law professor out in California. She's written the very important book, Drones and Targeted Killings, Legal, Moral, and Geopolitical Issues. Marjorie, thank you so much. We hope our listeners go out and get this book. It's very important.
It is, Marjorie. It's incredible. I mean, ours just came a day or so ago, and I got through it, and it's extraordinary, and I recommend it highly. So thank you, Marjorie.
Thank you, all three of you, so much.
Visit us online at lawanddisorder.org for archived programs and links to many of the issues we discuss.
Since 2003, private military contractors have been awarded hundreds of millions of dollars each year by the U.S. government. People working for these contractors have engaged in war crimes with zero accountability. Last week, a federal jury convicted four former Blackwater private security contractors on manslaughter charges and one for manslaughter and murder of 17 Iraqis in Baghdad in September of 2007. The men were prosecuted under the Military Extraterritorial Jurisdiction Act, a law that allows the U.S. courts to hear cases against contractors to the U.S. Department of Defense for crimes committed overseas. The men were originally hired as private security guards for U.S. government employees, like people that work at the embassy. Lawyers for Blackwater, a mercenary army, paid for with our taxes, now known as Academy LLC, argued that the men were simply returning fire to protect themselves. Several civil cases filed by victims injured in the shootings were settled in 2010. Attorney Susan Burke represented plaintiffs in those civil cases, and she now joins us today to talk about the criminal case.
Susan Burke, welcome to Law and Disorder.
Thank you. Thank you for having me on.
Last week, we had a victory in terms of guilty verdicts being brought against all four former Blackwater security guards who were charged in 2007 for the killings of more than 30 Iraqis in Baghdad. Tell us about the significance of this verdict.
Well, I think the verdict sends a very large and loud message to the globe that the American judicial system can operate properly, that American juries understand when they see war crimes, they understand when they hear about a massacre. So I think it shows that the system is able to function.
Susan, you go back a long way with these cases, and I'm interested in where they fit in. I remember when you came to CCR years ago after Abu Ghraib photos came out, and we sort of sat around and it was decided, primarily by you, I think, at the time, we can't sue the country, so let's sue some of the private contractors. Bring us back to that early days and how that came about and what happened in those cases and then where this one fits in.
Sure. Actually, we began working even before the Abu Ghraib photos were leaked. And basically, it began when Bob Woodward wrote a story for the Washington Post that revealed that the Bush administration had decided to use torture as an instrument in the war. And so we you and I met, we began to work with University of Pennsylvania law students, and we viewed the outsourcing as a potential weak flank, in a sense, in order to try to bring forward, use legal mechanisms, use lawsuits in order to try to prevent this country from departing from its values. We had only one client at the time, a gentleman who had been an anti-Saddam activist and who had then been tortured at Abu Ghraib. And he had contacted us prior to the photos leaking, but we're starting to put the lawsuits together when the photos leaked, and suddenly we had a lot more evidence, and we were able to sue the two government contractors, L3 and Khaki, that were involved in the Abu Ghraib torture. On those cases, we ended up getting a split, in large part reflecting the political views of the judges. So the D.C. Circuit and Judge Silberman and Judge Kavanaugh threw out the case and did not let us proceed. But in the meantime, we had started another series of cases in the Fourth Circuit, and there we were able to get a win en banc, and we were able to obtain compensation for those victims. And so the Blackwater story kind of fits in that rubric where we brought seven different lawsuits along with Center for Constitutional Rights. We brought the seven lawsuits for the victims of the Nisour Square Massacre as well as for many other victims. Because we were able to get the favorable law developed in the Fourth Circuit, we were able to negotiate compensation for all of those victims.
Susan, how did you get jurisdiction to bring these cases in the United States?
Well, if you think about it, we're going to the home turf of the wrongdoers. So the corporations are American corporations. They are based in Virginia, actually. And so we sued them in their home turf. And you always have personal jurisdiction when you go right to the wrongdoer.
You just won a recent victory, a relatively recent. And can you explain that? Was that against Khaki? I get the names mixed up because they change so often.
It was against Khaki. There's basically the Fourth Circuit has now said that there's one case remaining that is being handled by Bahar Azmi over at the Center for Constitutional Rights. And they just got a win from the Fourth Circuit, again, getting permission for the case to proceed. So that's on the last four victims of the Abu Ghraib torture. The vast majority of the victims have settled, with L3, the company, paying $5.25 million. But Khaki, the company that provided the interrogators, is continuing to fight it out in court.
Let me take you back. Let's go back to Abu Ghraib for a second. Who are the main contractors involved in our allegations of torture at Abu Ghraib?
Khaki has always remained the same. It's capital C-A-C-I. And they provided the interrogators. The other company is a company that was, at the time of Abu Ghraib, called Titan. And it's now called L3, another large defense contractor. L3 provided the translators who were used in the Abu Ghraib setting, who were basically doing a lot of the hands-on torture in the Abu Ghraib setting.
Now, let me ask you about Blackwater. Was Blackwater at Abu Ghraib, and what is their name now if they weren't, and how does Nisour relate to all that?
Well, Blackwater is in a different position. Blackwater was a mercenary company that basically earned, over $1 billion from the State Department. They were not at Abu Ghraib. Rather, they were providing security to all of the diplomats and other Americans over in Iraq. And at the time, they operated, they were owned by a man named Eric Prince, a privately held company, operated without any sort of regulation or oversight from the State Department, and they were involved in a significant number of instances where excessive and unnecessary force was used. We sued Blackwater for the victims at Nisar Square, and we also sued for several of the other excessive force cases. Blackwater ended up, Eric Prince ended up entering into a settlement, and all of those folks obtained compensation. Prince then sold the company, although he retained a revenue stream from the company, but he sold the company, and it became a company named Academy. They actually went through a couple different, you know, name iterations. They were called U.S. Training Center, but right now they are called Academy. And the one thing I think is noteworthy, and the reason I was so elated to see the jury verdict, is that as a nation, we continue to use these mercenaries, and we continue to lack any sort of regulation or oversight. Unfortunately, things did not change under the Obama administration and under Secretary Clinton at the State Department, and so we continue to have the same type of problems with these companies.
So do you think the Nisar verdict will send any kind of message to change Blackwater, to change the number of mercenaries the U.S. is using, et cetera?
Well, you know, I would hope that the government would give serious thought to whether we should continue to outsource. In some ways, back in 2008, the argument was, well, it was necessary. You know, we were just lacking people. We had to outsource this function. But as a practical matter right now, there's no reason that the Marines and other service members can't go back to the traditional function of guarding the embassies. But what's happened is that we have this terrible pattern where these companies have a lot of political influence. They continue to get enormous contracts. And, you know, the State Department continues to outsource security without having any sort of vibrant or robust oversight function. It's a handful of people that, you know, pay the bills on this. There's no real scrutiny. So, for example, if you have one of the mercenaries engaged in an episode of excessive force, he may well be fired by his present company. Say it's Triple Canopy or DynCorp. He may be fired by that company, but then he turns around and picks up another job with the other one. So it's really being run very, very poorly, with a terrible impact on innocent civilians.
Susan, to expand on what you just said, could you clarify the fact that in 2007, District Court Judge James Robertson found a dual chain of command existed where corporate employees were obligated to report abuses at CACI, and so the corporation could be held liable for such abuses, but also that the military exercised exclusive control over those L3 employees who worked as translators. How does the military control mesh with the private corporations?
Well, and that decision by Robertson was actually overturned by the D.C. Circuit, where we had the panel involving Judge Silberman and Judge Kavanaugh going against us, where in a beautiful dissent written by Judge Garland. Essentially, the way the case law has developed nationally is that if the military is literally side by side and giving direct orders to the corporate employees, the military's own sovereign immunity will end up cloaking the corporate employees. If, on the other hand, which is primarily the case, the contract and the understanding between the military and the contractor is that the contractor is supposed to be performing and corporate employees are supposed to be engaging in the oversight, then you are able to sue and you are able to keep going and get the liability for the corporation. We see that. We have a case going now where Halliburton and KBR were hired to provide all of the waste disposal services, and they didn't do it properly. Instead, they just burned everything open-air burning. And so you look at, okay, well, you know, is this something that the military is working side by side? Or was it something that they just brought in a company to handle the task? get different results depending on the different facts on the ground.
Susan, did you represent some of the families of the victims at Nisour?
Yes, we represented the families of those who were killed, and we also represented many who were injured. And along with Michael, your colleagues from the Center for Constitutional Rights, we flew over to the Middle East and we interviewed the people that were there at Nisour Square on the day of the massacre. And I tell you, it is just, it was such a horrific event, so traumatizing, and so many people impacted. I mean, it was the middle of a busy day in Nisour Square in Iraq.
Can you describe just very briefly what happened in Nisour Square on that day, at least from your discussions with some of your clients?
Sure. Basically, the Blackwater vehicles rolled into Nisour Square, and they began to open fire with heavy automatic weaponry. And they simply began to spray indiscriminately. They began to shoot all over Nisour Square, killing people that were nearby and injuring people as they fled. It's one of these instances that I think will kind of go down as a national disgrace for history. I mean, it was a really sad event that occurred. No provocation, no real reason that they began shooting.
What was their defense, though? I mean, they had to say something. What were they saying?
Oh, they said that they thought that one of the cars was beginning to shoot at them. The problem is that none of the witnesses on the ground had any weaponry, and there was no shooting. And most importantly, and I think an important part, is that one of the Blackwater men, a man named Jeremy Ridgway, he actually stepped up and told the truth early on, pled guilty, and explained how this was, in fact, just indiscriminate shooting for no reason. So, and this is why I think you see the jury verdict, is because we did have an American, we did have one of the wrongdoers stepping forward, taking responsibility, taking accountability.
Yeah, that's remarkable. I'd forgotten about that. One other question on this is, since the verdict, have you heard from any of your clients and what their reaction has been?
No, we really haven't. I mean, it's terrible the way things are in Iraq now. We've really lost touch with most of them. When they were here in town in D.C. to testify, I was able to speak with some of the victims at that point. But since their return, I have not heard from them. And we attempted to get word out to everyone about the verdict, but, you know, using the email and the like, but we're still not sure exactly if everybody knows.
Susan, what happened to Ridgway, the man that came forward and told the truth?
He pled guilty, and my understanding is he has not yet been sentenced.
From your feeling in Washington and where you are, is there any reaction within the government, within the State Department, within the politicos about this verdict and how they're looking at it?
I actually think that there has not been enough of a government reaction. There has been no discussion or scrutiny of, you know, do we need to continue outsourcing? Are we controlling it? I believe that Senator McCaskill has begun to focus and has been holding some hearings and some scrutiny of Blackwater and the other companies, but we really need more energy and more attention to these issues.
Susan, what kind of resources did your law firm have to throw into this lawsuit to make, in quote, the system work?
The civil lawsuits involving both Abu Ghraib and Blackwater, just because of the need for the travel to the Mideast and the, you know, to obtain translation when you interview the clients, it ended up really being significant millions of dollars to try to bring these issues to light.
I want to say a word about Susan. When we met, Susan was at a different kind of law firm, at a much straighter law firm in Philadelphia. By the time we filed these cases, Susan, I'll let you tell the story, but you were no longer there.
I ended up really, in order to try to properly handle these matters, I ended up just creating my own firm and heading out on my own. What I found when I had been at a firm, and it was just too difficult for corporate defense attorneys to understand the importance of it. And so although they were supportive and let me do it, it just wasn't a good fit within the firm. So kind of set me on a path that I'm still on of trying to bring social impact litigation.
Well, how do you marshal those kind of resources where you have to raise millions of dollars to finance a case which may end up losing? How did you do it? It's an extraordinary thing that you did.
Well, it's still kind of a work in progress. I can't say we've actually gotten everything paid for. My husband and I did incur a significant amount of personal debt that we're still struggling to keep going. But you know, at some point, I had in my head we shouldn't let lack of resources stop us from doing it right. So. We took a bit of a gamble. We used some of these litigation lenders, and we're still plugging away. So I'm confident we'll eventually have a fully happy ending.
Susan, it's an extraordinary story. I mean, your personal story on this, because I remember when you first walked into CCR, you know, who would have ever thought there'd be any chance at all of actually getting settlements for scores, if not more, people in Iraq in these cases? I mean, we're still, I think, in shock, and it is, you know, a testament to your incredible persistence in these cases, as well as everything in your life changed, essentially. So, anyway.
Well, Michael, I appreciate you saying that. And the one thing that these cases have made me focus on is this disconnect between corporate profits and the damages, because as a practical matter, the way we measure damages in this nation is essentially by your income. You know, what does a middle-class family in Iraq make? And then, you know, punitive damages are constitutionally limited to a multiplier of that compensatory. The problem with foreign victims is that the amounts that are able to be recouped are so modest that it doesn't serve as a deterrent to these to the multinational and the American corporations. So I really think this is another issue where we need to think long-term about legislation so that in these particular circumstances of very impoverished foreign victims, you could have a punitive award that's large enough that's de-linked from the compensatory in order to serve the deterrent role of tort cases.
Yeah, I would agree with you. In fact, I'd go you one better and say we got to think long-term of not getting involved in these imperial wars, which cause this kind of damage to people to begin with.
Agreed.
I can't remember the name of the film, but it's about sexual abuse, rape in the military. And I'm watching the film. You'll tell me what the name is. And you were a semi-star in the film, if not the star, for help all these women who were completely shut down in the military, their complaint system shut down. And you, you know, represent scores of those people, if not more. Just tell us the name of the film and give us a sense, is that struggle still going on for you?
Yes, the film is called The Invisible War, and it was put together by Kirby Dick and Amy Ziering. We filed a wave of lawsuits that were the subject matter of the film. That led to a fair amount. We ended up getting legislation voted on. We got 55 votes in the Senate, but we fell short of getting past the filibuster. So I'm actually in the midst right now of preparing a second wave of lawsuits, and we're going to continue to fight the battle on Congress. In a nutshell, the problem is that the military judicial system, which is responsible for prosecuting rape and sexual assault, is dysfunctional. It has a dismal track record. It manages to convict less than 1% of the perpetrators. And so as a result, you have just an extraordinary number of rapes and sexual assaults going on. The last count by the military's own number was 26,000 per year. So really another national disgrace that needs to be fixed.
Now, I remember how incredibly moved I was by the film, and of course it was such a nice thing for me to see your important role in that, continuing the kind of work that we first met when you began. So again, thank you so much for this, Susan, and I know we'll be talking to you again and again.
Thank you, Michael. Yeah. Thank you for all your support. I tell you, I wouldn't have gone down this path without you. You're
don't
a big
motivator. Don't say that. Your
me.
Husband still blames me. Okay.
Yeah, congratulations.
Thanks, Susan.
Thanks for being on Law and Disorder.
Take care. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.
If you want to hear Law and Disorder again, go to lawanddisorder.org on the web. You should also go to Law and Disorder Radio on Facebook.